policy increases the number of gallons required, we will shift over to the second generation of ethanol, which are the cellulosic efforts or the biomass fuels. It's very important for this country to pursue ethanol production, not only for corn-based ethanol production, not only for domestic security and energy security, but also to provide economic activity in rural areas. And as we invest in corn-based ethanol, we're increasing the infrastructure, we're building pipelines and getting more tanker cars, we're building billions of gallons of capacity so that when the science-based research gets done with biomass generation, we have an infrastructure so that the people of the United States can take advantage of it. That will then move us away from a dependency on one feedstock into a wide variety of feedstocks, which then is driven by the market conditions. That's an important step for us. But today, on a global basis, and you know, the United States gets beat up for this a lot, and internally and externally, our public policy shows that of the 43% increase in inflation and food prices this year, 1 year, about 3% of that will be driven by ethanol production in the United States. If you add biofuels to that, mostly biodiesel, and of course, you know, in the United States we don't use much biodiesel, so they can't accuse us of distorting that. But you know, in many European countries there are strong users of biodiesel. But if you look at that global price structure on biodiesel and add that to the United States-based ethanol, you move from 3% up to a little over 10%, 11% influence. So while ethanol production and bioenergy is a factor in the food price inflation, it is not the factor. The driving factors continue to be energy, petrol-based chemicals, energy costs, gasoline, diesel costs, packaging materials, as well as increased global consumption in the face of reduced yields because of weather. So as all of those mixes change, what we predict in the United States and is a leveling out of these food price inflations this year, and over the next several years we'll continue to see this level and then a gradual drop off. That is all based, all my comments are based on pre-flood issues, by the way. And we're just now learning the impact of what the floods in the Midwest are going to do for corn yields and what they're going to do for prices. And we just don't have a handle on that yet. Monday we'll be releasing our normal June crop report. We've done expanded and double back survey with producers in the Midwest to get some sense as to where we are. I haven't seen those numbers yet. I don't know what kind of response rate we're going to have because people are flooded out of their homes. But, you know, we're trying to get a handle on these numbers. We're also going to do normally we do June and August. We're going to do a July crop report to, again, get some handle on where we're going. So that's kind of the, you know, where we are today on the food and feed issue. No, you know, there's some calls to relax the renewable fuel standard, but you know, as we've looked at this pretty thoroughly, I always like to do things that can make a difference, and changing the renewable fuel standard won't make a difference in food prices in the foreseeable future. Down the road, it may, but we don't know that. The renewable fuel standard this year says we have to build about 8 billion gallons of ethanol. We can do that. We did that, you know, easily. We've got more capacity than that. The renewable fuel standard allows us to use imports. And while we have import fees on ethanol, certainly the supplies are there and capable to meet the renewable fuel standard. And, you know, shifting out of ethanol or the encouragement of mandating of the number of gallons that need to be produced. I hate to say government and mandate in the same sentence, but in reducing those mandates for the number of gallons produced, the capacity is there. We think that the feedstock is there. The ability of the American people to respond here without changing the renewable fuel standard is meetable. And importantly, that renewable fuel standard puts us on a path of energy self-sufficiency and continued economic growth in rural areas in this country. And it's one of the most important directions that we're making in as far as public policy today.
One last question.
Yep. Yes, you know, the Farm Bill had, or the last Farm Bill, 2002 Farm Bill, had a sunset clause on the import fees for ethanol. They were supposed to drop off in about 2 years. The administration supported allowing those fees to lapse, and unfortunately Congress decided in the new Farm Bill to advance those fees for years to come. You'll have to ask them why they wanted to do that. It doesn't make a lot of sense to me. But with the fee basis and the reduction in the subsidy payment on the, for the blenders by 6 cents that was done in the new Farm Bill, there still is a little premium to be paid by imported ethanol and the import fees. But it still is economically feasible at this point in time for blenders to use that, and we think they will. But specifically, if we could see those fees reduced and eliminated, we certainly support that. Yes? You know that whole speculation thing has been kind of difficult to get your arms around. Well, maybe not yours, but it is for me. I haven't been able to try to figure it out. I've been on the commodity exchange floor here in Chicago. I've been in Kansas City. I've talked to the boards, the members about this whole issue. And, you know, their contention is that as the speculative money has come in, it's been married to the hedging of crops by individuals. As the big companies have gotten out of the hedging business, as local elevators and individual producers have gotten more into it to pick up the slack, as we've seen huge increase in the cost of producing a crop and the risk that comes with that, a lot of farmers and ranchers are hedging out there, and the new money in the marketplace goes to hedging. That's the theory. I don't think there's no doubt in my mind that there is speculative money in here that are driving up the prices. People that don't know the markets, that don't know the commodities, that are looking at long-term trends and say, gee, the price is going up over here, I'm going to buy some, and then I'm going to sell if the market goes up or goes down, is kind of what the free market system is all about. Now, should we be regulating that or not? I don't know. The House bill, the House passed a bill last night that says if you buy a futures contract, you have to take delivery of it, I think. Double check that, but that's where they were going when I left town. that's always subject to change. But, they were talking about, providing legislation that said, if you are in this, if you're knowledgeable about it and you buy it, then take it. That would severely change, the speculation in it. What I'm concerned about is I believe in the law of supply and demand, and I believe in supply-side economics. And if we're going to stop the speculation on the upside, we also stop the speculation on the downside. And, I think it's often government, rushes into things and doesn't look at the complete picture. So, I'm concerned about this. But I have no doubt that there's an element in the price increases due to speculation, and I think you can see it more readily in oil than you can in soybeans or corn. What we should be doing about it, I'm not sure. A piece of it certainly is speculation. Well, yeah, we're getting a lot of pressure on the early release of CRP without penalty. I like to point out that farmers can make these decisions today. They pay back the people of the United States of America who supported their operations, when they do so. Now, there are some people in the country today that, because of the financial risk and reward, are making those decisions. They're paying the penalties, and they're putting that land into production. The question becomes for us is this time, do we need to stimulate food production? As you know, I made the announcement a month ago that we were going to allow haying and grazing on all CRP acres, about $1 billion worth of feed and forage put into the marketplace, hopefully that displaced corn and soybean and wheat use for feed. We need to do everything we can, to provide the acres and yields of production. We made the decision earlier in the year not to allow an early out without penalty for the 08 crop, but we only had about 1 million acres or so coming out of contract this fall. Next year there will be a total of about 4 million acres, and it goes up after that. So the dynamics have changed. We are looking at a lower supply, lower holdover stocks, and weather conditions that are causing problems. We're taking into consideration all of those factors, and I'll make the decision on what to do about early release of CRP shortly, within the next weeks. I was originally looking at the end of August, early September, to make these decisions. We've accelerated that because, for instance, if we release some, and that would go into winter wheat, which is a pretty immediate crop. You've got a lot of field preparation that must take place, and so we're going to have to make these decisions soon so that farmers and ranchers know where we're going. But to date, we do not have a decision to do so. Okay, did you have? Yeah. We in the United States government have a three-prong approach to the food crisis that's out there today. One is short-term, two are long-term. Short-term, obviously, humanitarian aid. The United States provides 50% or more of all the food aid out there every year, and we're proud to do so. and we're going to continue with that. That's the immediacy. The longer-term aspects are the second prong is infrastructure development, how we can provide better water systems, better farm-to-market roads, better fertilizer management, better refrigeration, better electricity, all the things that are needed to produce food in a sustainable manner. Too often, attention gets paid when people are hungry, and then they get some food, and then attention goes away. The real tough focus is to do the work long-term, sustainable. And we're committed to doing that. We're creating new pots of dollars for infrastructure development. We're funding increased research, regional research labs in the area, increased agronomy expertise and extension services, all those things to develop the effort long term and to build. If we're going to meet the United Nations goal of doubling the food supply by 2050, we can't do it. We can't do it. Right now, we couldn't do it today. If you look at coarse grain production, the United States and Argentina are the only two countries in the world that are increasing yields to meet the increase in demand. If you just take corn out of that, add Canada. U.S., Canada, and Argentina are the three. Nobody's doing it in wheat. We need to understand the need to increase yields, and to increase yields, you got to increase infrastructure. So that's the second long-term piece. I'm pleased that USAID is now moving money into infrastructure development instead of just food. The president's request of $770 million from Congress to do this issue includes $250 million in infrastructure development. So, we think we're – and I was pleased, the time I spent in Rome at the World Food Conference – the focus is shifting to that infrastructure development than just food aid. The third piece is the opening of markets. We've got to work to remove export restrictions, duties, fees, governmental interference in the free flow of food and seed and research between countries, and that's also a long-term effort. So one short-term, two long-term is the focus that the United States has. Well, you know, the best thing to attract investment is a stable government. You know, we see a lot of instability in a few countries, but we're seeing, you know, some of that long-term stable government, the handoff of public policy direction investment in those countries. That allows you to build a legal system. It allows you to build an inspection system. It allows you to build a risk management system, you know, in place. And that's what business looks for. You know, they want to make an investment, and they want a return on that investment. If you're going to get a return on investment, you've got to have good governmental-to-business relationships. And that's the biggest thing that you can develop in those countries. Certainly, you know, people being hungry forces humanitarian efforts. If we can get the business community to focus that humanitarian effort is also a long-term investment effort, that's important. The government has the big hands, the big resources. We can do the food and the aid and distribution. You know, we need infrastructure development, and that's what we're asking the business community to do.